we know that there's a stereotype that I have no idea where it came from, but it's always existed. And I've been approached by Black people, Asian people, white people about it throughout my career as an adult, saying that Black people have heavier bones, so they can't swim or they find it more difficult to float. So we are working with the RNLI and the University of Portsmouth to actually carry out research to do with bone density and body composition and floatability in the water. And that's just one of the examples of kind of the work that we're doing together. We're looking to kind of remove barriers and psychological barriers as well.
Welcome to the Propulsion Swimming Podcast, where we aim to give swimming the coverage and publicity it deserves. Every week, we celebrate the sport we love with amazing special guests and topics from around the swimming pool. And now, here are your hosts, Scott and Dan.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Propulsion Swimming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend, Dan. And on this week's show, in line with the upcoming summer holidays, we are talking more about water safety.
Yeah, we've got a big episode for you guys today, covering two very big topics, which I think are both equally as important as each other. We're joined by two great guests to talk us through why these topics are so important and what we can all do to increase awareness in this country and hopefully beyond too.
Yes, so let's not hang around this week. Let's get straight into it. So please welcome onto the podcast, co-founder of the Black Swimming Association, Saren Jones, and RNLI Water Safety Education Manager, James Woodhouse. Thank you both for joining us on this week's show.
Thank you for having us.
James, if we start with you, what is the RNLI and kind of what is your role there?
Yeah, so the RNLI is the Royal National Lifeboat Institution. We've been around almost 200 years, so we actually celebrate our 200-year anniversary in 2024. So a couple of years' time, we'll be having a big party to celebrate 200 years of the RNLI. And what we do is, well, we save lives at sea. That is our motto. That is our everyday mantra. And you may have seen when you've been to the coast, our big orange lifeboats. And that is kind of our bread and butter work. That's what we do, is we send our lifeboats out to rescue people who may be in trouble at sea. But we also have a lot of preventative work, which we're going to talk about, I'm sure, a lot later on. And we also have our lifeguards as well that lifeguard beaches between May and September. But our motto is we save lives at sea. That's what we do.
Amazing. How does the RNLI operate exactly? I've heard, is it run 100% by volunteers?
Almost, yeah, pretty close. It's actually 95% volunteer run, which is an incredible stat, and one that still kind of, you know, is a shock to me every day when I kind of think about that, or somebody asks me about it. To be run 95% by volunteers is an incredible thing. So yeah, we rely on our volunteers. We wouldn't be able to do what we do without that 95%, if you can imagine. If you took that 95% away, what the RNLI would be, it would be nothing like we have today. So the majority of the lifeboat crews, so the ones that do our, you know, our calls out to sea, they are volunteers. So they are everyday people, you know, policemen, teachers, bar staff. We've got people who own fish and chip shops right next to the lifeboat station, etc. They are, you know, giving up their spare time in the middle of the night, Christmas Eve, their birthdays, kids' birthdays, etc., to drop everything to go and save lives at sea. So incredible people and an incredible organization to be a part of.
Now, before we get into the full conversation of this podcast, I'd really like to touch upon how does someone become a part of that team? Just in case people are really inspired by this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's 95% of those roles are volunteers. So there's a lot of different roles within the RNLI to be a part of. If you wanted to be volunteer crew, which is kind of a lot of, you know, when we go out and talk to people, that's what people see, because they, the volunteer, to be on the crew is an incredible thing. You have to be 17. So that's the first point of call. You can't do anything until you're 17, and it takes a bit of training. So we don't just let people on the lifeboat straight away, as you can imagine. These lifeboats take a lot of skill to be a part of. So there's a bit of training to go under. We put our training through our crew through the most vigorous training, really top level stuff. We have our headquarters down in Poole, which has a kind of a big indoor pool where we could replicate storms and thunder and we bring the blinds down, we can flip the lifeboat over on this indoor pool so we can kind of replicate that real life scenario. So they get the very best of training. So they'll go through a period of that training and then they can kind of work their way on onto the lifeboat from there. But, you know, like I said at the very start, it's whilst our lifeboats are our kind of bread and butter, there's a variety of roles within the RNLI. So we obviously have our lifeguards alongside that as well, which, again, you have to be 17 to be a part of. And again, there's a kind of a vigorous training to go through before you can be a part of. But then there's all of our I won't call them behind the scenes, but everything else that goes on to make the those lifeboats and lifeguards the very best at what they can be. Unfortunately, I do that, which is great.
Nice. And Saren, you're a co-founder of the Black Swimming Association. So first of all, what is it and what's your role there?
So the Black Swimming Association, or the BSA now as what we're most known as, is a charity that myself and three of the co-founders set up 2 years ago. The two things that we had in common, the four of us, was that we all loved swimming and aquatics and we all happened to be Black. And we had all noticed throughout our journeys in aquatics and swimming, whether they were recreational or competitive, that we just weren't represented, you know, like across the board. So we set up the organization to get people from African, Caribbean and Asian communities engaged in the world of aquatics, but also to educate them about water safety and to contribute towards kind of drowning prevention, because we see kind of every summer when we have our ever so fleeting heat waves in the UK that last a week or so, unfortunately, you know, we do see stories where people go out and they want to spend time by the water because it's hot and, you know, they want to enjoy their day. And some people don't come home because it turns out they don't know how to swim. And anecdotally speaking, a lot of those people tend to look like me. They are Black, they are brown, they're not white British. So it's something that we wanted to highlight to the community, because the aquatic sector has so much to offer. As you guys know, you know, swimming is just such a fantastic thing, and it's the gateway to everything to do with water sports. But my role specifically at the BSA is I am the head of communications. So I work on everything to do with social media and media. And that's primarily because my background is journalism, and I'm a journalist. So I balance both jobs. And sometimes I don't really know how I do it, actually. I had one of those days today where I was like, panic! But it's all worth it. It's worth all the stress. I love it.
Yeah, I know. We certainly know about that. There's a lot of startling statistics behind the BSA and kind of why you launched as well, isn't there? So if you've got any of them to hand, or if you know any of them, do you want to take a deep dive into a few of them, just almost to shock people a little bit?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, I'm not quite sure how much these will shock people, because I feel like we've been saying it, like, you know, just constantly since we set up, and we got these stats just before we established the charity from a Sport England survey, which showed that 95% of Black adults in England do not swim. 80% of Black children in England do not swim. And when it comes to Asian communities, that's 93% of Asian adults in England and 78% of Asian children. And this isn't to be mistaken for cannot swim, but there's certainly an overlap there. That's what's been acknowledged. And what we want to do is to figure out why so many people in these communities do not prioritize swimming, whether it's for health benefits, psychological benefits, is it to do with accessibility, is it to do with cultural reasons? Because like I said before, swimming has so much to offer, you know, beyond kind of its physical benefits. So we want to be able to kind of help skew those figures and give people who look like me or who look like my family members the opportunity to actually enjoy swimming, and so they can witness it and experience that benefit in their lives as well.
Yeah, well, one of the co-founders, Alice Deering, became the first Black female to represent GB at Olympics in swimming. How much of an impact has she had to inspire the Black community?
You know, I still don't think Alice has realized the impact she's had. Like, she's very much like, you know, she's your elite athlete, you know, like, it's head down, I'm training, that's all that really matters. But to represent Team GB in the water at the games, the fact that that hasn't been done before and it happened in 2021 is just crazy. Because, you know, we all know in society that, you know, people of all different ethnicities and backgrounds are athletic and are fantastic, and when given the correct opportunities, can flourish and can dominate. But it's just looking in the aquatic sector and in anything to do with water sports, we don't really see that domination or that what appears to be from the outside, that appetite when it comes to those communities and swimming. Not that that's the case. A lot of the time it comes down to accessibility and to about what you can and cannot afford. But Alice has had a humongous impact. You know, she's not just for young girls. And it's fantastic that she is a role model, and she is the first, but we really hope that she's not going to be the last. And we're very aware that we don't want Alice to be the poster girl for Team GB when it comes to Black representation, because there are many more. You know, there are so many, the percentage of, you know, Black communities across the country, you know, we are a minority, but there are plenty of us, and there's no reason why there shouldn't be more Alice Dearings. So, you know, it's just the beginning, but she's done a phenomenal job so far.
Absolutely. So both the RNLI and the BSA, I think if everyone has taken away from that introduction, is you both do amazing, fantastic jobs. And the overall aim of this podcast is to raise awareness for the work that both of you guys do. But there's also a partnership between yourselves. So when did you both go into partnership, and why did this partnership form?
So this partnership was announced last summer officially. The BSA, since our establishment, has had quite a lot of attention, positive and negative. You know, I think what we're doing is fantastic, but a lot of people consider it extremely controversial. We are all about inclusion, but it's not actually at the exclusion of others, despite our name. Yes, we do focus on Black and Asian populations, but that's because the statistics are, as you've just heard, startling. They're so much worse. So that's where our focus is. But the RNLI is one of the most established charities in the country. It's 200 years old. It's got, you know, a fantastic reputation when it comes to saving lives and water safety. And a lot of, you know, the two missions of the charity overlap. And it's been a real privilege over the last year kind of working with the expertise of the RNLI. You know, we often call our partnership a marriage, and it's like 200 years versus 2 years. You know, we're very much learning from the RNLI, but they're also very much learning from us. It's been fantastic so far. We get to meet up, I think, twice a year. We recently, the BSA team went down to Poole again last month, where I met James for the first time. And we're planning to bring James up to London so he can see the work that we're doing, because we work with grassroots organizations here. But it's just really important, I think, to be able to learn from each other in order for us to actually do what we need to do, which is save as many lives as possible, whether they're at sea or whether they are in a pool or in a canal. It doesn't really matter where it is. It's just so that people of all ethnicities and backgrounds, especially our communities, know what to do if they happen to get in danger when they're in the water.
I think what Saren said there is the most important thing. Yes, it is a marriage of two organizations, but what we can achieve together is far greater than what we can achieve separately. So to have that kind of amalgamation of two organizations that are striving for that same goal, and that is our outcome. We want to save everyone. Both organizations want to save everyone. So to be able to do that together gives us a far greater propulsion, if excuse the pun,
I like it.
To be able to achieve that goal.
Well, that was kind of my question, actually. I was going to ask you, what are you both doing to help each other? Is there certain campaigns or anything like that that you're trying to do?
Gosh, what? I mean, what aren't we doing together, James?
That's what I was just thinking in my head. How do we answer
yeah,
that?
Do you want to talk about your new role?
So I actually am starting a new role within the RNLI. My role is senior program lead, but I'm leading on the programs for the RNLI and the BSA. So if we think about that marriage, I guess I'm the priest of that marriage to keep those two organizations kind of lapping over to make sure we're achieving the same things that we set out to achieve, which we will. Yeah. But yeah, from tomorrow, that's my role, which is very exciting.
I mean, that just shows the the commitment to the partnership that they've created a whole role to make sure you continue to work in tandem.
And I think that's important. And I think, as Saren was saying there at the start, the BSA got a lot of organizations going to them. And again, Saren, I don't want to speak on your behalf, so please interrupt me if I'm not wrong. But during the kind of Black Lives Matter movement, there was a lot of organizations that approached the BSA to almost show themselves in the right light, I guess you could say. But what we can achieve, as we spoke about, as two great organizations. And, you know, I almost describe it as the RNLI as a tanker and the BSA as a jet ski. So the RNLI has got this kind of weight behind it. We've been here 200 years. You know, we naturally have that kind of not so much popularity, but recognizability of people who see the RNLI. Whereas the BSA is relatively new. It's 2020. It's 2 years old. So they've kind of got that jet ski kind of fast maneuverability about them. But between us together, the kind of having that tanker and the jet ski analogy, we can achieve what we want to achieve. So I think it's an incredible partnership. The possibilities of what we can achieve together are fantastic. And from a personal point of view, I've been down in Poole a couple of weeks ago and spending some time with the guys from the BSA and chatting to them about why they do this is incredible. And yes, it's really exciting.
And what James just said about kind of our relationship and that analogy, it's a really great example of one of the projects the two organizations are doing together, because we've got some research that's been commissioned that we want to focus on physiological aspects of the body, which is us with the RNLI and their expertise, but also the University of Portsmouth. And that is to look into body composition and floatability, all to do with can people float and how do they float? And this came up initially because we know that there's a stereotype that I've no idea where it came from, but it's always existed. And I've been approached by Black people, Asian people, white people about it throughout my career as an adult, saying that Black people have heavier bones, so they can't swim or they find it more difficult to float. So we are working with the RNLI and the University of Portsmouth to actually carry out research to do with bone density and body composition and floatability in the water. And that's just one of the examples of kind of the work that we're doing together. We're looking to kind of remove barriers and psychological barriers as well that, you know, do face certain people. I think there's accountability on both sides. The aquatic sector historically has been designed not to serve a humongous population of this country, but also very detrimental and dangerous myths have existed, which a lot of people in the community have also used as an excuse to not get into the water, you know? So it's all about kind of like untangling and unpicking kind of these layers. And that's something we're really looking forward to doing with the RNLI and the University of Portsmouth.
It's breaking, yeah, because I've heard these myths as well, obviously being a swimming teacher for so many years. And I'm just like, where did these myths come from? Like you said, the bones are denser and they can't swim, they can't float. So I don't understand where this narrative has come from exactly.
Neither do we, Dan. Neither do we. That's why we're putting it to the test. So we'll let you know when we get that research. It's something that we're going to be carrying out towards the end of this year.
And that isn't something that you could have achieved or spread the message as well without the RNLI.
That's something that we wanted to do with the RNLI because it all comes back, you know, floatability, it all comes back as well to water safety. You know, if you know how to float and you mentally think that you can't float, you're going to be in immediate danger when you go outside, whether it's kind of not just swimming in the sea or in the pool, but even just kind of getting into on a kayak in a canal in East London, you know, you're still not particularly very safe. If that kayak is to topple over and in your mind you're thinking, I can't float, what's going to happen to you? So with the water safety education and messaging of the RNLI and the expertise at the University of Portsmouth, we really want to come together. I mean, there's no better team really to do it and to actually put this to bed, you know, so it's very exciting.
Absolutely. And ahead of these summer holidays, the RNLI does actually have its own targeted summer water safety campaign. So James, what is the key messages this summer?
Yeah, so we're expecting, we called last year our busiest summer ever, but we're expecting this year to be our busiest summer ever, if you like. So we're expecting about 35 million people to make a coastal visit this year. So that's, you know, almost half the population we're expecting them to go at some point to the coast this year. That's about 5 million more than we saw last year. So whilst we called last year our busiest summer ever, like I said, we're expecting this to be even busier. There's various reasons behind that. The biggest, obviously, being COVID. We still are having that knock-on effect of people not going on abroad on summer holidays as much and staying within the UK. So we're expecting a lot of people at the beach. So what we've launched our summer campaign alongside the Coast Guard, and what we are advising people to do and what we are sharing is our Float to Live campaign. So our Float to Live campaign is very simple, exactly as it says on the tin, is if you find yourself in difficulty in the water, then you try and float. So lay on your back, almost in a starfish shape, so arms and legs nice and wide apart, and keep your head above the water. It is actually a skill. It's not something that happens naturally. So we encourage people to, if they are in the swimming pool, to practice floating on your back, so it isn't the first time you're in trouble that you're gonna have to use that position. So we are encouraging people to practice it, but yes, we're encouraging people to know the float position, and it is, or it has been, known to save lives. We've got about 30 case study examples of people that have said that hearing about the float position in whatever format has actually saved their life. And I think what we need to talk about or be aware of as well is this is not just a coastal project, and we are spending more and more time thinking about those inland waterways that people use in terms of canals, lakes, reservoirs, etc. Exactly the same rules apply. Whilst obviously there are different aspects of going to the beach in terms of the tides, etc., which can make a difference to people's safety, there is also all those fundamental issues that can happen in inland waters. So yeah, we're talking about our Float to Live campaign. So if you find yourself in difficulty in water, just lay back. It's easy to say, but try not to panic. I know that's easy for all of us to say sat in a nice dry room. If you find yourself in water unexpectedly, you naturally are going to panic. But we try people to just stay nice and calm, get themselves in that float to position, try and get their heart rates low, take some deep breaths, and then they can make that next decision, whether it be can they swim to safety? So if they're close enough to the nearest part of shore, can they swim there, or can they kind of raise their arms and raise the alarm in some way. The other thing we're encouraging people to do is know what to do if they see someone else in trouble. So if there is if you see someone in trouble in water wherever you are, that to call 999. That is the first instance. That's what we want people to do immediately, is to call 999. The quicker they can do that, and the quicker they can raise the alarm, the more chance we have of being able to get there in time. There are a few different circumstances here. So if they're at the coast and they call 999, they should ask for the Coast Guard. And if they are inland and they see someone in trouble, they should call 999 and ask for the fire service. They're the people most equipped to send a rescue that way. So yes, we're expecting these huge numbers at the coast this year. And whilst we love that, we love people being on the beaches, we love people being in the water, we're encouraging them to do it as safely as possible. Please try and find a lifeguard at the beach. We lifeguard over 250 beaches every year. So whilst the one you go to may not be, or it may be the nearest beach, if it isn't lifeguarded, please do go onto the RNLI website and put your postcode in, and it will show you the nearest lifeguarded beach. It may be 5 miles further down the road, but it is naturally safer to swim at a lifeguarded beach than it is at an unlifeguarded beach. So yeah, please do that.
Yeah, 35 million is a lot, isn't it? It is a lot of people.
And Seren, it links back then to the research that you guys are trying to do by trying to disprove this myth that you can't float. Do you know the direct correlation between the summer safety message and why it's important that you guys break the myth at the same time in order to fully implement this message?
Yeah, definitely. You're completely right. And we proudly use the RNLI water safety messaging in the BSA community as well. So one thing that we do is we have what we call our swim program is called Together We Can. It's not a learn to swim program, but it's a water orientation program that we offer to residents in Hackney. The aim is for them to have a positive experience in the water in one of our leisure centers, and to learn how to float, to know what to do if you are if you do get into trouble in the water. And then through our 5-week cycle, they just happen to learn how to swim as well. So if you think about the participants that we have on board, and if you think of the spectrum from 0 to 10, most of our participants are actually on minus three, because a lot of our swimmers are either extremely aquaphobic or extremely novice, or have had some sort of traumatic experience with swimming, or a near death and a near drowning type experience with swimming, or just haven't had the time or had access to a pool for years. So we really do emphasize the water safety messaging that the RNLI has, you know, float to live, go together, call 999. Do you know whether to ask for a Coast Guard or the fire service, depending on where you are across the country, even where you are in London? You know, Thames is Coast Guard, but everywhere else is fire service. And it's really important. And we actually had a really great day last Thursday where we had one of our participants came in. We're currently holding women's only session, and most of our ladies are in the age range of kind of 40 to 50. So one of our ladies came in and she said, "Oh, I was at the library the other day. I was at the library today and I met this Asian woman. We got talking. I told her about these sessions because I love them. And she said, oh, I can't swim." And she called over a friend who is also Asian and said, "Oh, neither of us can swim." So what our participant did straight away, she went into the water safety messaging mode. She was like, "Here's what you do. If you go down to the canal, make sure that, you know, you don't go alone, call 999. And she literally, everything that we'd been teaching them, it just kind of like came out. And we were like, well, that's literally what it's all about. You know, it's about kind of enjoying the experience, having that messaging, you know, sent to somebody through an enjoyable and positive way, and then having them feedback to the community. And, you know, it's fantastic that the RNLI have their campaigns and, you know, their big billboards and the marketing, which, you know, has a humongous impact. But, you know, it's also the word of mouth stuff that is really, really powerful as well to those who maybe may not see the RNLI stuff, you know, whether it's on socials or in different parts of the city. So the messaging that the RNLI has is really, truly fantastic. And we're really proud to help push that through the BSA in our communities.
Yeah,
yes. Yeah. I mean, we talk a lot about like swimming pools and in a controlled environment, and the message you're saying is absolutely true, and everyone should definitely abide by it. But there are definitely differences between being in a swimming pool and being in the ocean, for example. So, what differences are there? For example, James, let's go with you.
Yeah, so we touched on it briefly. There obviously are, being that controlled environment in a swimming pool, there are no tides, for example. There's no currents. Which are the ones that catch people out the most when they're at the sea. So we've all heard of what a rip current is or how it works. Basically, it is a part of the water that is coming into the beach that gets funneled into a different section. They're incredibly hard to predict. They're incredibly difficult to spot as well. From a kind of a standing point of view from the beach, you almost certainly can't spot it, and it's only until you're in it that you kind of realize where it is and what's going on. That is what we find most people get in trouble with at the beach. How we deal with that is, obviously we have our lifeguarded beaches, and our lifeguards are trained professionals, so they are trained to spot a rip, and they will put a red flag out if they see a riptide or if they know one's forming. So if you are at the beach and you see a red flag, please adhere to that. That means don't go in the water for whatever reason. Even if it looks perfectly calm and it's a nice hot August bank holiday day and you're thinking, why are these lifeguards put a red flag out? They're just trying to annoy me and ruin my fun. I promise you they're not. They've put the red flag there for a reason. So please don't go in the water if you do see a red flag. We have two red and yellow flags. That is the safest place to swim. So if you hear somebody say swim between the flags, that's what they mean. Swim between the red and yellow flags. There'll be two, so it'll be marking an area. So please go within those flags if you're going into the water. A big one, and kind of our big campaign last year, but we will always talk about it, is the use of inflatables at the beach. So inflatables should only be used in those controlled environments in terms of swimming pools. More than happy to see people in inflatables or unicorns and swimming pools on holiday. That's great. But what we don't want is to see those unicorns or bananas or whatever inflatables the latest fashion is at the seaside. They're incredibly easy to be washed out to sea. It literally takes the slightest of breezes. An offshore breeze, as in it's coming from the land out to the sea. It's incredibly easy for those to be washed out to sea. So please don't use inflatables at the beach. Keep them for the swimming pools. That's pretty much it. I think an interesting stat, if we can call it that way, is a lot of our rescues are people that don't expect to be wet that day. And what we mean by that is We call them slips, trips and falls. So a lot of rescues or shouts that we go to are from people that are walking dogs, running along coastal footpaths, those sort of things. That is a big part of what we do. So we just try and make sure that obviously they're paying attention to where they're running. Don't run or go close to the cliff edges. Give yourself a very good distance away from them. And also a lot of people we go to are dog rescues or rescues of dogs that have gone into the water and their owners have gone in after them. Unfortunately, it's the owner that we have to go and save. Dogs are incredible swimmers. 99% of the time, they will get themselves out of that scenario and we end up having to go and rescue the owner. So please keep your dog away from the water if possible. Keep them on a lead. But if they do get into trouble, please try not to go in after them so we don't have to end up rescuing you. So yeah, like I said, the importance of swimming in a lifeguarded beach is really really important, and just pay attention to those flags.
Loads of really important messages there, and I would reiterate that to our whole audience, because I'm sure a lot of people listening here will feel very accomplished swimmers. I think that is genuinely our target audience. They are former club swimmers, but you're not immune to these issues and these obstacles that arise at sea. Don't think just because you are a very accomplished swimmer in the pool that you will be in the sea. I'd stick within the red and yellow flags.
Sometimes I think as well, it's like, James, correct me if I'm wrong, but because when you are a confident swimmer, sometimes you're more at risk because you think that you're going to be fine, or, you know, you swim out a little bit further, or, you know, if you're over the age of 18, you might feel like having a drink before you get into the water. And it's all these kind of extra elements that actually make us vulnerable to those situations that we can't foresee because we're so used to being in those closed, controlled environments. So it's definitely something worth thinking about.
I think it's important to think about using the correct equipment. So if you are a open water swimmer, which is great, you know, like we said, everything we are talking about, we're not trying to put people off swimming. We're not trying to put people off going in water. Water is a fabulous thing. We all love it. But what we want to do is make sure people do it safely. So if you are an open water swimmer, making sure you're using a tow float, making sure you've looked at the tides. Don't kind of get complacent about what you're doing, because it's that kind of 1% complacency that, you know, could put you in trouble. So obviously make sure you keep on top of it. I think what's important to note quickly, just whilst we're on this subject, is last year we actually saw an increase in accidental drownings for the first time in a few years. So it actually went up to 277 accidental deaths around the UK, which was 23 more than the previous year. So again, we can attribute that to various different reasons. And again, we could say that COVID is one of those reasons, because people, you know, so happy to be outside again, etc., and maybe aren't thinking so much about the safety element side of things. But what we just need to be aware of as a community and as a country and everything else is just making sure we're not getting complacent in those water situations, making sure that we're using the right tools, that we are doing it in the correct manner. We're telling people where we're going. We're having a means of calling for help if we are getting into trouble in whatever way that may be, just so we make sure that we are keeping ourselves safe.
And where can people find this information or even learn more about these? Is there online resources that you both have actually on your own websites?
Yeah, so feel free to go onto the RNLI website. So it's rnli.org. We have a variety of resources on there. If you are listening to this and you're a teacher, a swimming teacher or a teacher of any kind, we have various water safety resources on there from, you know, year one up to 18 and over. So please do go on there and look at our water safety resources. Spend a bit of time having a look around at what you can do and what you can share. Like I mentioned before, there's our postcode checker for our lifeguarded beaches, which again is a very important tool. And there's plenty of things on there that you can kind of have a look at and share.
And Sarah, before we kind of finish this conversation with a few kind of quick fire questions to really emphasize the points we've talked about, I'd like to touch upon, have you guys actually found any of the obstacles that are preventing Black people from taking up swimming, and what can be done to increase the awareness?
Well, unfortunately, there, like all things in life, Scott, there are many obstacles that are preventing people in the community from learning how to swim. And it's not as black and white as just kind of pinpointing on one. But based on kind of research that we've done, we currently have our adult social research that's been commissioned. It's called Our Swim Story, where we're encouraging people from the communities to get in touch with us. You can go on ourswimstory.com and share with us your aquatic experience, positive, negative. There's a forum you can join. You can send a voice note or a video, or you can just do the survey. But we know that there are loads of different factors. There are factors to do with accessibility, which tends to kind of fold under the category of finance. You know, swimming is a more expensive activity than other things. You know, if you're kind of going to go outside and play football or, you know, go running or netball or basketball, usually all you really need is a pair of trainers because the ball is provided or the bibs are provided by the team or the equipment. With swimming, you need, as you guys know, a swimming costume, a hat, goggles for luxury. And that's recreationally. And then you need a pound for your locker and you need to have towels. And when you're competitive, you know, quadruple all of that, obviously, and then add the fast bins, add the entry fees for the galas, add the petrol mileage or the train tickets to get there, add the accommodation for British nationals or British champs or whatever it is. And all of a sudden you're spending a lot of money, let alone time, in an aquatic environment. And for a lot of people, it's really not feasible. And even if you break down and go back to the recreational side of it, you know, a pound for locker might not seem like a lot for somebody, or £5 entrance might not seem like a lot for somebody. But for some families who are from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, who maybe, you know, have one parent, multiple children, parent is working more than one job, it's not the most convenient of options when your child can stay fit and active in an easier, probably a more local facility. We know that COVID has exacerbated the pool situations. Pools all closed. Obviously, some of them have opened up, but some of those in some of the older pools aren't opening up again. Some aren't being refurbished. And a lot of those older pools are in poorer areas in this country. That's affecting communities as well and their accessibility. So you've got that. You've got cultural reasons. We know that there's been a huge conversation recently around hair. And we've seen a response to that where you've got, you know, fantastic swimming caps now that have been invented to protect afro hair or longer hair or thicker hair from coming into direct contact with chlorine, which is great. We've seen the same rise in modest swimwear for women who don't want to expose their entire physiques and their entire bodies. So swimming is becoming more inclusive in that way. But there are a load of barriers, and you know, we haven't even touched on the psychological stuff. You know, that I can't float, or I have aquaphobia, or my mum told me to just stay away from the water, and that's what water safety is to me. You know, you've got all of these other elements, and the psychological stuff is actually the hardest because you're really trying to challenge somebody's frame of mind and a belief somebody has had ingrained not only in them, but usually in their parents and their parents, and it's a generational thing. So we've got all these different barriers coming from all different angles that we're trying to tackle. But you know, it's very rewarding and very humbling to be part of the BSA. We are the only Black aquatic organization that exists, and we've had to exist for a reason. But working with the likes of the RNLI and other partners, like James said, you know, we can do so much more together than we can all do separately. So it's definitely worth doing. I mean, it's all about saving lives and drowning prevention.
Yeah, I mean, actually, my list of first quickfire questions is, why is the partnership between yourselves important? But I think all of those obstacles just answer it, because there are massive obstacles in the way of the Black community getting involved with swimming. So any sort of water safety message out there is key around any body of water.
Exactly. Yeah. And like James said, it's not just about going to the beach, it's or going to the pool. You know, like London, Birmingham, filled with canals, filled with, you know, bodies of water that aren't around the coast, you know, and a lot of, you know, lower socioeconomic areas are in these spaces. You have canals next to estates, you know, next to box of flats where families live. It's really important for everybody. You know, it's not just a case of, I should learn because I enjoy swimming. It's, I should learn because drowning doesn't discriminate against anybody, wherever you live, whoever you are, what color you are, your sexuality, it doesn't matter. Everybody should learn how to float, what to do if they are in danger in the water, in the same way that police officers and fire service people used to come into primary schools and tell us, what do you do if you're approached by a stranger, or what do you do if there's a fire? You know, water safety is just as important as that information that these kids are getting. So we want to be able to really drill that into everybody. So we don't have to have these summers where people are losing family members, because it's just not fair.
Yeah, I think it should be introduced in schools a lot more than what it already is. I think when you get to the age of year six, I think it is that you've got to do at least 25 meters, which I think is anywhere near enough as what it should be. So I think there needs to be more stuff done in schools, and hopefully with what you guys are doing, hopefully that'll be introduced in school life. That'll be quite good.
Touch wood.
Fingers crossed, eh?
Definitely.
So I'm gonna cap things off by saying, or asking James to repeat, what are the key messages for this summer's water safety campaign?
Yeah, so if you are one of those 35 million people going to the beach this summer, remember float to live. So if you find yourself in difficulty in the water, lean back on your back, arms and legs wide like a starfish. Try and take some nice deep breaths. Try not to panic, as easy as it sounds. Take some deep breaths. Try and get your heart rate down. And then you can make your next decision, whether it be swim to safety or call for help. That is what we're telling people this summer. If you see someone in trouble, call 999 as quickly as possible. Ask for the Coast Guard if you're at the coast, fire service if you're inland. Try and keep your eyes on that person in the water that you've seen in difficulty. Another important key point is not to go in after them. We don't want to end up rescuing two people. Try and keep it to one person. So keep your eyes on that person in the water. And then we just want to make sure that you're safe this summer. So go to a lifeguarded beach. Make sure you stay with other people. Try not to be near water alone. Stay with people. If you're going with family, if you've got younger brothers, nephews, etc., sisters, just keep them close. Keep your eyes on them. Don't let them go near the water alone. And then we just want to make sure everyone's safe.
And even if you're not one of the 35 million going to the beaches, just please stay safe. And just, you know, the water safety messaging is relevant to absolutely everybody, whether you're going to the beach this summer or not. So, yeah. We all deserve a good summer. So, and that water safety messaging will definitely contribute to that.
Yes. Well, awesome. Thank you both for coming on to this week's show. I've learned loads. I'm really excited to see where the partnership between both organizations can go in the future. And good luck with any future campaigns that you guys have as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much. You're both obviously doing a fantastic job, and whatever posts you put out there on social media, we will definitely retweet or share or whatever else to spread this message, because it's super important. And yeah, obviously we don't want people to drown this summer. We want to just enjoy ourselves, but you've got to, of course, be safe as well.
Thank you so much for having us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Cheers.
So that just about rounds up this week's episode of the Propulsion Swimming Podcast. If you haven't subscribed already, please do so on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. And me and Dan will be back in 7 days' time.
Yeah, thank you for listening, everyone, and we'll catch you on the next one.
You've been listening to the Propulsion Swimming Podcast with Scott and Dan. We want to thank you for joining us and invite you to subscribe to the show, as well as checking out the Propulsion Swimming YouTube channel for weekly tutorials and videos to get your swimming fix. We will be back next week. Until then, we'll catch you on the next one.